thoughtfully in the glow of our torchlight. "I'll walk in there and tell him," Ernie says simply. No one says a word. Then Chubbs bursts out laughing, his belly wobbling. The laughter settles a moment later when we all realize the old man is serious. "Jesus, and I thought Bram was crazy," Saunders says. "You two were meant for each other." "They'll shoot you as soon as you set foot on site. You won't make it inside," Chubbs says. "Yes, I will," Ernie says. "What makes you so sure?" Saunders asks. "They went to such desperate lengths to cover up the murder of my wife, then created such an elaborate fiction about me to justify locking me up for all these years when they could have just killed me then. It's all about perception. Creating this facade for the public, showing the world that they were doing what was right for Eve." "But things have changed now. The world is different," Chubb says. "People don't care as much since they started being so secretive about Eve. Showing us less of the real Eve we used to see and more of their manipulated version." "He's right," Saunders chips in. "If the public aren't interested, the EPO won't think twice about killing you." "Then we need to make the public interested. We need to make people care again," I say.
"How?"
Chubbs asks. "We need every person in Central at the EPO gates. We need every lens of every camera, every holo player pointed at those front gates, just like they were there when Eve was born, beamed on those screens around Central, around the world, to witness the return of Eve's father after all these years. Reformed, rehabilitated, ready to see his daughter," I say, staring at my team. Ernie smiles, despite the tears in his eyes.
"They won't have any choice but to open up and let him inside," Saunders adds excitedly.
"But what about once he's inside?" Chubbs asks. "I'll refuse to talk to anyone but Cartman," Ernie says. "Hartman," I correct him. "Sorry, Hartman. Don't worry, I'll get it right on the night." He chuckles with the youthful glint of rebellion in his old eyes. "Yes, but once you're out of sight of the crowds, there's no guarantee they'll cooperate. No guarantee they'll allow you anywhere near Hartman," Saunders says. "He's right. You need to call him out to you," I say.
"What?"
Ernie says. "You'll need to stand outside the front door in broad daylight and say you won't go inside or talk to anyone but Hartman. With the world watching, they won't use physical force on you," I say. "Say the plan works up to then and Hartman comes out. Then what? How can I tell him without telling everyone else watching?" Ernie says. The four of us fall silent again and mull over this new conundrum. "I could be dead for all the EPO, no?" I say, the dust of an idea gathering in my mind. "I could easily have been caught up in the blast at Grimm's Ditch." "True," Saunders says. "They won't assume you're dead, but they'll certainly know it's a possibility." "So tell them you've come to deliver a message to Hartman in person," I say, suddenly having an idea. "Tell them you won't answer any questions until you've given him the message. Let them think you're delivering news of my death to my best friend." Ernie smiles and nods. I can see that the thought of his part in this mission is igniting a fire inside him, like he's been waiting to free his daughter his whole life and this is his shot. "Assuming they play along and Hartman comes out to greet you, you tell him this. Your dear friend Bram is at peace. He is now with his mother."
"Your mother?"
Chubbs asks.
"She's in CS," I say.
"Are you sure he'll know what that means?" Chubbs asks.
"I mean, it's not giving him much to go on."
"It's as obvious as we can afford to be," I say. "What if he doesn't believe me?" Ernie asks. I think for a moment. Then I feel it. The cool metal hanging around my neck. I slip the silver cross over my head and hand it to Ernie. "Give him this."
"You believe in God?"
"My mother did. It was hers," I explain. "Well, we need one now more than ever," Ernie says, placing the chain over his head and tucking it safely under his cotton shirt. "If we can get Ernie's return out there for the public to see, the whole world will be watching, waiting to see what happens next," Saunders tells me.
"I know," I say.
"I know."
Chapter 58. Eve. "Vivian hasn't been in," I say the following morning, when I hear Mother Cardi walk through the door. I'm glad that she's come with a key for the cuffs, which remained on my wrists all night. The skin beneath them is now red and sore, but that has hardly troubled me at all. Instead, my mind has been busy batting away the inevitable nightmare visions fighting to invade my head. At first, I tried to stop myself nodding off, Sure, the horrors would infiltrate my sleep, but they came anyway, bringing with them a night of cold sweats, vomit, and anxiety. I'm relieved that it's now the start of a new day. A new day feels hopeful, somehow, as though it comes with fresh possibilities for new discoveries. I'm still none the wiser on how to move forward after yesterday's revelations, but a new day symbolizes new opportunities to make sense of it all. I keep telling myself that more will become apparent in time. The world around me is starting to unravel and show its true self. I just need to be open and alert to what I see and hear around me. Once I have more information, I'll be able to formulate a plan somehow. She's been busy, Mother Cardi says, seeming distracted as she hands me my cup of tablets before laying the tray by my side, revealing a breakfast of fruit and herbal tea. While she arranges my clothes for the day, I tip the tablets into my hand and take a closer look at them, thinking of how many I've taken over the years. Vitamins, as they say, or another lie. I quickly place them under my pillow before Mother Cardi turns back to me. Everything okay? I ask. Of course it is, darling. She smiles, nodding in her usual upbeat manner. Yet I hear the wobble in her voice and see the bottom of her eyes fill with tears. I know she's lying. She stops and takes a breath. I'm sorry, she chokes, putting the clothes she's fetched on the bed. I will have to ask Mother Tabia to get you ready today. I'm not feeling too well. Mother Cardi, I call, as I watch her flee. I meant to be gearing up for implantation, but my altered egg will be returned to me and my womanly attributes given their first proper test. As I'm not sure if I failed in my mission to destroy that egg, and anything else they hold of me, it's unclear as to whether the previous plan is going ahead. All I know is that if it does, I want Mother Cardi by my side. I know I can trust her. Stay with me, I call, my hands reaching out and imploring her, wondering what's changed since yesterday to make her so distant and distracted. I pull back my bedding and am about to go after her, but as she flings the door open and runs through it, I feel lightheaded. I take a deep breath and close my eyes, but the feeling intensifies, my body heavy and uncontrollable. I try to call out to Mother Cardi for help, but nothing happens. I can't seem to open my mouth or shout. I know I'm exhausted from the previous day's events. Although they've tried to build up my fitness with dance, boxing, and martial arts over the years, yesterday I moved in ways I've never had to before. I overexerted myself too soon after the crash. My body is paying for it now. Ever so briefly, my mind turns to my mother. Her body couldn't keep her and me alive. It failed us. Maybe mine will be the same. Maybe my own future is doomed. Maybe history will, inevitably, repeat itself. My fingers rest on the rough patch of skin on my wrist, a heavy sadness creeping in at the thought of what might have been. Wave after wave of wooziness washes over me, nausea building. I close my eyes and take a deep breath, slowly letting the air go, then sucking in a fresh lungful and feeling it disperse around my knackered bones. Well done. My eyes snap open. Vivian is standing at the base of my bed, looking at her fingernails as though I don't warrant her full attention. You've really made quite a mess downstairs. A ball of destruction. Good, I say defiantly, sitting a little taller against the headboard, forcing my dizzy head to pull itself together while she's in front of me. I don't want her to think of me as weak. Not only that, I don't want her to panic and restrict my life here any further. To be bedbound would be horrendous. Her eyes flick up to lock with mine, pinching together in a squint of disgust. I know all about your lies. I don't want to be any part of it, I declare, an eyebrow edging skywards. I know. We heard, she says, with a sickly smile, glancing to the corner of the room where a chrome security camera is staring straight back at us. It was quite the emotional display you performed last night. All that weeping and sobbing, she mocks, her hands rolling in a circular motion while her face drops to mimic mine. She stops suddenly, her face deadpan. You shouldn't be putting yourself under so much strain. Like you care. Eve, she sighs, sounding exasperated, as though I'm being unreasonable in taking offense. You have to start leading with your head, not your heart. Meaning? What we're doing here is for the greater good. By playing God. By sacrificing the overpopulated to give a chance to those who can make a difference, she says, cocking her head to the side. Girls? Of course. And what if I can only produce boys? We've been working on that, on your behalf, she shares, as if I'm an accomplice in her plan. We couldn't have left it to chance. A boy would have been a failure. You wouldn't have wanted that. Everything you saw downstairs was done for you. My jaw drops in horror. Then I say, I don't want that. I didn't do any... Your emotional attachment is natural, Eve. But this goes far beyond mothering a child. It's a fight for survival. If we don't manipulate nature, if we don't use the science we've created to its full potential, we've lost our right to be here. It's more than a game of win or lose. By doing what you're suggesting, we don't deserve to be here anyway, I yell, my body becoming hot as I speak. Mother Nature didn't just turn off her love for us overnight. It's actions like the ones you're committing that turned her against us in the first place. The lack of respect for her... magic, I say, searching for the right words, which is not easy when I'm debating with Vivian. Her ability to give life and love is what has led us all here. We have to show her we care, that we've atoned for whatever monstrosities occurred before. An interesting thought, she nods slowly. I mean it. We can't just repeat past mistakes, I say, my hand on my chest. You're right. Vivian purses her lips but is unable to hide the start of a smile. Let's see what she does with your atoned and caring heart tomorrow. Pardon? I swallow. Implantation, she whispers flamboyantly, her eyes round with surprise as she mocks me. You have not forgotten, have you? We've been monitoring the process. The fertilized cells have been multiplying perfectly. My resolve drops along with every muscle in my face. Vivian's face twists into a snarl. That's right. Tomorrow is the special day when you will collect your potential offspring and give her the chance of life. She's already waiting for you, Mother Eve. Her cells multiplying, her budding future sparkling with possibility. All she needs now is her kind mother, who recognizes the beauty of life. A girl who finds those who crush any promise of life abhorrent and cruel to collect her. She's already here, Eve. Congratulations. I have nothing to offer her in return. Enjoy your day exploring the wonders of the dome, she says, her voice thick with sarcasm. I'll be waiting for you tomorrow night. With your daughter. I was wrong. Vivian is, as ever, two steps ahead of me. I'm exactly where she wants me. In just 24 hours, my fate will be sealed. I will be trapped here. Forever.
Chapter 59. Bram. Two teams, I announced to the watching crowd looking down at me from every angle of this grand submerged room. Briefly, I become aware of the importance of this moment, of the effect my words will have on the future for all of us. Either way, what we do next will make history. But how will we know if the other team is successful? Helena calls, and I see Anne and the women from the sanctuary standing around her. We won't, I reply without hesitation. We will be working completely in the dark, zero communication. Once I'm in the tank, I won't know if Ernie has succeeded in passing on the message until I'm revived. If he fails, I'll never find out. And what if you fail? Another voice calls. What happens to Ernie? Then I shall face my fate in the tower alone, Ernie replies as he stands at my side. I've been an observing prisoner for too long. It's time to play my part. I look around the room. It's silent. These men and women, these Freevers, have been no more than protesters and rioters for years. Now they are soldiers, an army, and war is imminent.
Helena, you will lead the tower team. You're to escort Ernie to the EPO tower at sunrise. We have leaked messages throughout Central hinting at something monumental occurring at the tower today. Expect crowds. This is to be peaceful. This is the epic return of Eve's father. It is not a protest. You are to keep Ernie hidden and protected until he is ready. Then give him space. We want the world to see this. Show the people that even after all these years, the EPO can't destroy the love of a father for his daughter. There are a few mumbles around the room, people discussing the plan, but no one questions it. Helena nods at me, accepting her mission. Coal team, you're with me. This will be a little tricky. We'll be secretly boarding the morning delivery to the cold storage levels of the tower. I flick a switch and the projector splashes an image of the large ship, armed guards pacing the deck. There are whispers around the hall. We'll have approximately 20 minutes to board, make our way to their storage level and, well, the rest is up to the docs here. I nod to Dr. Oliver and his small medical team, who will accompany us onto the ship.
What happens after that? After Ernie shows up, it's going to be mayhem down there. The crowds will be massive, an old Freeva calls down from the balcony.
Yes, and that's exactly what we want, I say.
It'll be hysteria again, like back when my Eve was born, Ernie adds. The crowds won't leave.
And neither will we, Helena cheers, and voices rise in agreement.
Stay hidden among the crowds. I can't say for how long, but if we succeed, we'll need you out there waiting for us. If I make it out of that place, I won't be alone.
The room is silent. Everyone trying to picture the impossible image of Eve leaving the tower.
How will we know?
The old voice speaks again.
How will we know if you've succeeded?
Trust me. When the time comes, you'll know. The meeting comes to an end after hours of intense talks, memorizing river bends, studying the blueprints of the EPO ship, preparing weapons and loading the equipment we'll need. I hand a portable holoplayer to Chubbs, and as my fingers slide over the smooth surface of the projector screen, my mind skips back to Johnny. Poor Johnny. This plan has to succeed for him, for all he did for us, for Eve. My heart pauses for a moment. Johnny's work. It gives me an idea. Leaving Ernie was hard. I could see the emotion in his eyes as he boarded the pod with his new army. These people who looked to him as some sort of saint, the man who gave them hope, the father of their beloved Eve. His whole life has been building towards this moment, the moment he would return to the tower to free his daughter. But that won't happen unless I succeed in what I'm about to do. What the hell am I about to do? This is crazy. I step into the small black dinghy, which is already occupied by Chubbs and Saunders. Helena emerges from the clock and she looks down at me with the expression of a woman prepared for battle. She looks more ready for this than anyone else. I tilt my head and beckon her closer. Take this, I whisper. She takes the package from me, trying to work out what is concealed inside the large camouflage shoulder bag. It's heavy, she says in a low voice, her watery eyes scanning mine for clues. There's a letter for you inside. Only you. Must be a pretty long one. What am I meant to do with it? When you need this, it'll be obvious. It's vital that no one knows this part of the plan, just you and me, I explain.
Ready?
Chubbs interrupts us. Helena nods.
Let's get going, Chubbs calls.
The dawn air is cool and brings with it a sense of promise, as if a new era is rising with the sun and only we select few are aware of it. Dr. Oliver leads the small medical team into an identical dinghy next to ours. We push away from the side of the enormous clock face and drift out onto the open river. Helena watches us float away, her long grey hair starting to vanish into the mist that forms between us. I see her mouth two words and offer them back in reply. For Eve. It's already busy on the water, people sailing to their places of business, trading goods on the waves from boat to boat. It feels surreal to see such normality ahead of what is potentially a historic day. Soon their holoplayers and displays will be dominated with news of Ernie, the return of Eve's father. Part of me wishes I could be around to witness it, but I have my own task to focus on now.
There it is, Saunders announces. In the distance, the shadow of a large black vessel appears through the cloud of murky pollution. It breaks through the smog and pushes up the river. Shit, this is scary, Chubb says. It's okay, I say in my best fake calm voice. I can't let him know how much my own nerves are making my insides twist. There's a small boarding deck on the rear starboard side. One guard, max, if any, Saunders says. Leave him to me, he adds, as he pumps a red lever on a long rifle-shaped weapon. A high-pitched ring fizzes out as it charges. I look at him for reassurance, and he understands. It'll knock him out for a few hours. Non-lethal. He won't remember it. Don't worry, he says. I nod in thanks. I don't want any unnecessary deaths, or the attention they would bring. We steer our two tethered dinghies through the traffic, blending in among the countless boats, rafts, and ships. They won't see us coming. The EPO vessel draws closer. I see the familiar uniform on the armed guard standing on the top deck. It makes my blood boil now, seeing that patch with the tower embroidered on it, beaming out from the guard's chest. Everything it represents is a lie. It's time, Saunders says, and gestures to our captain, who steers the dinghy towards the center of the river, weaving through the traffic. The EPO's ship pulls alongside us, slowly overtaking our boats and all the other small craft we're hiding among. From his position at the front of our dinghy, Saunders subtly takes aim, keeping the weapon hidden under his waterproofs. As the ship pulls in front of us, I see the small docking bay, an opening in the back. I feel our dinghy vibrate under my feet as our captain accelerates to match the speed of the target. I don't see anyone, I say, trying not to look too hard at the ship. Me neither, replies Saunders. The bridge is approaching, says Chubbs. I take a look around the side of the giant black ship we're tailing and see it. This is our cue. This is our chance. Our only chance. Once we're under it, we'll have about 60 seconds of darkness to get on board, I say quietly, even though we've gone over all this 100 times now, more for my benefit than anyone else's. The bridge, an enormous concrete structure, crosses the river about half a mile ahead. It's one of the few crossing points from one side of the new city to the other, now that all the original bridges are rotting at the bottom of this vast river. All water traffic has to pass under it. It's dark and noisy. The perfect place to board. As the ship enters the darkness under the bridge, the concrete shadow ripples over it like a wave until we too are under its blanket. Our engine roars to life, and we rapidly gain momentum. I wrap the wet ropes on the side of our dinghy around my wrist and hold on as we bounce blindly over the wake of the EPO ship. As my eyes adjust to the lack of light, I see Saunders slip a pair of glasses onto his face that subtly illuminate his eyes. He can see in the dark. Suddenly, he dives onto his stomach, leaning out over the front of our dinghy as it rushes towards the opening at the back of the ship. He rests his head on the silver gun in his hands, and a brilliant blue flash sparks out, lighting up our immediate surroundings like a lightning storm. In the flash, I see a body hit the deck in the open dock of the vessel, bolts of electricity frying his black overalls as he lies motionless. Clear! Saunders shouts, over the deafening roar of the ship's engines as our inflatable boat bumps its nose up and onto the open dock. I nod at Chubbs, and he follows me as I leap onto the ship. Once the two of us are on deck, our dinghy falls back, making way for the medical team to board. I crouch and take the pulse of the stunned guard. He's out cold, alive, but unconscious. As Dr. Oliver and his two assistants scramble towards the front of their boat, a second blinding flash blasts over our heads. I hear a heavy clang and a sudden thud, and see a second body hit the deck. Another guard. I glance out at the river and Saunders gives me a look that says, "Close one." I give him a nod of thanks as the medical team climb on. I take a breath. We're on board. Chapter 60. Bram. We move quickly, the stomping of our boots lost in the noise created by the ship as it slices through the river towards the tower. "Two flights down," Chubb says, referring to the three-dimensional map shimmering on his holo player, our destination highlighted by a flashing red beacon at the bottom of the ship, inside a sealed room within its hull. The five of us descend in the dim light, the change in temperature noticeable by the visible breath escaping our mouths. "Not far," I say, seeing the worried expressions of the medical team as Dr. Oliver and his two men hesitantly follow. None of us is a soldier, but especially not the three shivering doctors who have volunteered to be here. Their lack of combat training and experience is starting to show. "We're going to be fine," I say as I lead them down the dark metallic staircase into the unknown. We reach the bottom and are confronted by an imposing door that looks like it would be more at home on a military submarine. A large metal wheel seals the room beyond it. A thick glass porthole glows with a cold blue light, but it's impossible to see through the ice crystals that have formed on it. "This is it," Chubb says. I reach out and turn the wheel. It's stiff, frozen. Chubbs grabs hold too and we turn it together. It takes all our strength, but eventually ice fragments crack and fall to the floor as the metal lock twists in our hands. After three turns, the wheel stops. We step back and pull out the gun Saunders gave me before we left the deep. I double-check that its non-lethal lock is on and take aim before giving Chubbs the nod. The medical team duck behind me as the thick metal door swings open. If any room is going to be guarded on this ship, it's this one, where they store their precious cargo. As a cloud of chilly air escapes it, the cool blue light of cold storage hits my face. I take a moment to scan the room. "Clear," I whisper. Chubbs steps in front, his round figure blocking the doorway as he takes the lead. I can sense his fear growing with each step he takes into the eerie hull of this vast ship. We follow slowly, all of us expecting someone to jump out at any moment. The room is packed with huge 7-foot-tall cylinders. Our distorted reflections mimic us in the frosted chrome as we step deep into the hull. "There are so many," Chubbs whispers, as he takes in the sight of what must be at least 50 cryotanks, which, they claim, will perfectly preserve the inhabitants' body, peacefully frozen, until the time comes for them to be revived. I'm counting on that claim to be true today. My heart starts pounding in my chest, as if it suddenly realizes the events about to unfold. I can almost hear it over the droning of the engine, trying to make up for the beats it will be missing. "Okay, Doc, it's over to you now," Chubbs says, coming to a halt at the center of the room. "Let's open one and prep the tank for two people," Dr. Oliver says. He walks down an aisle between the tanks, his small eyes scanning them through his glasses until he stops at the last tank nearest the wall of the ship. He wipes away the frost with his hand and reads the details of the woman inside it. The steady green light on the side indicates normal conditions within. "This one will work fine," he says. "Great. How long do you need?" Chubbs asks. The cooling process is rapid, almost instantaneous. The tank takes care of that, prepping the body. Dr. Oliver pauses, realizing this is no ordinary operation. "Ordinarily, the patient is deceased or placed in a controlled comatose state before this process begins. It has not been tried on a living, healthy young man such as yourself," he tells me. Again. "We have no other option," I say, already stripping off my jumpsuit, dropping my clothes onto the floor until I'm standing in a thin set of thermal underwear, designed to rapidly and evenly distribute the cold around my body as it freezes. As I pace the aisle, failing to keep myself warm, Dr. Oliver's two medical assistants climb the metal rungs of the short ladder connected to the side of the tank and begin unbolting the latches securing the lid. The seal gives a little hiss as the pressure holding it shut releases. They lift the chunky lid of the cryotank and thick white gas spills out, creeping down the side until it meets the floor where it disperses in every direction, eventually finding my bare feet. The two men slide the lid onto the top of the next tank and peer inside. "Whatever you do, don't touch that liquid," Dr. Oliver warns. "It's minus 190 degrees. Your blood would freeze instantly." The men move back from the opening and start climbing down. "Sir, it's going to be a tight squeeze in there," the first medical assistant says to Dr. Oliver, his young eyes betraying his doubt. I need to see inside for myself. I push past them and climb up towards the top of the open tank. The icy rungs sting the soles of my feet, but I push aside the pain. It's nothing to what my entire body is about to experience. As I reach the top, the last of the cloudy white gas disappears, revealing the liquid that fills the interior. It is crystal clear, like glass, with a subtle tint of blue. Chubbs, hand me a torch, I say, holding out my hand. I need to see inside. You don't need a torch, Dr. Oliver says as he walks around to the small box attached to the outside of the tank. He stares at it for a moment, looking for something. He finds it and pushes a button. The inside of the tank illuminates instantly. The light is white and harsh, and I have to shield my eyes to allow them to adjust. As I peer in through the opening, I feel the light on my face. Staring down, I see that the base of the tank is made up of a flat panel of lights blasting up at the body inside it, a lifeless woman floating peacefully. The doubtful assistant was right. It will be a tight squeeze, but comfort is of no importance on this trip. I'll fit, I say to the team. The woman inside is still. Her features are calm as her body lies in the supercooled liquid. Even her hair seems to float normally, showing no sign that every cell in her body is currently suspended in a deep frozen state. I've never seen inside one of these, only in photographs, I say, almost to myself. My mind flashes to thoughts of my mother and the countless times I've visited her, speaking to her through the thick walls of her tank, wondering at what's on the other side. It comforts me, seeing the serenity of the woman I'm about to share one with. Bram, Chubbs interrupts my thoughts. We've not got long. I nod. The freezing temperature of the room is already unbearable. Shivering, I slide on to the top of the neighboring tank and sit on the lid. Wait, Chubbs calls up to me. How's your pal supposed to find you? I glance around at the room full of identical cryo tanks. There'll be even more of these things in the tower, right? He asks. My heart skips suddenly. Pass up my jumpsuit, I say, reaching down to Chubbs. He hands my clothes up to me, and my trembling fingers search the pockets. What are you looking for? Chubbs asks. For a sign, I reply. I slip my fingers into the chest pocket and pull out a small strip of silver foil. I unfold it, and the sweet smell floods my nostrils. What the hell is that? Dr. Oliver asks. It's called bubblegum, I say, throwing the blue strip into my mouth. It's vintage. I chew for a few seconds, feeling the strip become soft and sticky in my mouth. I take the gum out and stick it to the side of the open tank. It's small, but it's better than nothing. I nod to Dr. Oliver, who climbs up after me and places his medical bag next to me on the tank. I glance at his equipment. Three syringes lined up neatly in a row, the silver needles glistening in the cold light. This is not going to be comfortable, he tells me. Let's get it done, I reply, not wanting to think about the effect the drugs will have on my body. You will need immediate medical assistance once you're removed from this liquid. Your friend Hartman, he'll be able to get you to a doctor, he asks. I don't have the heart to tell Dr. Oliver the truth, so I just nod. Strap this around your arm. He hands me a rubber band, then makes a fist and opens it a few times, showing me what he wants me to do. It takes only a few seconds for my veins to obey, the dark blue lines that carry blood around my body rising under my skin as though telling me they're ready. Good, Dr. Oliver says, admiring my arm. He picks up the first syringe. This first one is just a drip to administer the rest. You can look away. I don't move my head. I want to see. He shrugs and plunges the needle into my arm. I feel nothing as it pierces my skin, the cold temperature already numbing my senses. He places a small plaster over the point of entry, holding the needle in place as he attaches the tube to the end. Okay, are you ready? He asks. Yes, I reply without hesitation. Once I put this into your body, there's no turning back. He holds the first syringe up to show me. I nod. I'm ready.
He attaches it to the tube that plugs directly into my vein. This one will begin to slow your heart rate so your body doesn't go into shock when it hits the liquid, he says, and takes a deep breath. I see his thumb twitch nervously over the plunger of the small syringe. I reach out instantly and press it down for him, slowly administering the contents to my system, relieving him of the responsibility. No turning back now, I say, as the last of the drug flows down the clear tube and into my vein. He unscrews the now empty syringe and attaches the next. This one will feel strange, he says. It's to stop ice forming in your cells. Like antifreeze, I ask. Exactly, he replies. It's non-toxic, but it's not designed to be used on conscious subjects. It will allow your cells to freeze without becoming stiff. It prevents the damage of traditional freezing. Clever stuff, I remark. Once it's in your system, we must wait 3 minutes for it to distribute evenly around your body before you enter the tank. If your cells don't contain this drug, they will not survive the rapid cooling process. He slowly pushes down on the syringe and starts a timer on his watch. 3 minutes. I feel this medical-grade antifreeze flow into my body. It tingles at the spot on my arm where it enters, like cool pins and needles. The tingling spreads up my arm, and suddenly I'm engulfed. It's the strangest sensation I've ever felt. It's as though I'm aware of all the veins in my body. I feel them, all of them, all the thousands of intricate tunnels and pathways winding around my organs, twisting through my limbs. They're all alive, like they've been wired with electricity. It intensifies. The tingles become stabbing pains. Deep shocks strike every part of my body. Invisible fingers with razor-sharp edges tighten around my brain. My body convulses uncontrollably. I fall back onto the top of the closed tank, and through the shakes and twitches, I hear Dr. Oliver call down to his assistants for help. I black out momentarily. Suddenly, three bodies are standing over me. Bram? I hear Dr. Oliver calling. I'm okay, I say, sitting up. My head spins, my body feels weak. Your heart is slowing. You have 1 minute before you can be submerged in the chamber. Stay calm and breathe through the pain. Your body still needs oxygen, Dr. Oliver instructs. Another wave of stabbing washes through me. Sedative, I hear Dr. Oliver request. This will calm your seizures, he tells me as he sticks a needle into my neck. The alarm sounds on his wristwatch. It's time, he says. My body is limp. Vision blurs. I cannot stand. The three men hook their arms under mine and hoist me upright. Below, at the base of the tank, I see a large, hazy figure. Chubbs, I shout, but only a mumbled whisper escapes. The men wobble with my dead weight as they carefully lift me over the open tank. We must lower him swiftly, Dr. Oliver's voice instructs, while straining to hold me steady along with his two colleagues. Chubbs, I call again as my head flops forward. I don't have the strength to lift it. The men hold me over the liquid nitrogen. My feet dangle a few inches. I can't feel them now. I can't feel anything. My mind is escaping as I face my fate, the tank beneath me, the floating woman. On my count, Dr. Oliver calls. 3, 2, 1. As I fall into the tank, the world fades. I feel no cold. The super-cooled liquid freezes every cell in my body, but the chemicals Dr. Oliver put in my blood prevent them turning to ice. For the briefest of moments, a fraction of a second, I'm engulfed in the most excruciating pain I've ever experienced. This fleeting moment of unbearable suffering ends abruptly with the sound of Chubbs's worried voice echoing around the hull as it cries out to me, "For Eve!"
Chapter 61. Eve. My eyes open to the most beautiful sunrise I've ever seen. Purples, pinks, oranges and blues fill the window in front of me, all bleeding into each other to paint the perfect picture of harmony. As I lie there, looking at its splendor, it would be easy to forget my own reservations about the day ahead and what's to come. to believe that Mother Nature is trying to will me on. Why else would she shower us with her artistry and grace today and every day for as long as I can remember? She's luring us in, constantly winning us over, telling us we need to prolong our existence with her on this earth. The heavy block that's sitting in my stomach says otherwise. It fills me with a sense of foreboding and doom. My life is about to be crushed, controlled, and discarded, my dreams tossed aside for others' gain, but not for the benefit of my children. Instead, I'll be starting a chain of women who'll all be treated in this way, giving life for no life to be lived, producing another little cog. I'd rather have woken up to see nothing at all. A sea of black would have been my own preference on this pitiful day. Mother Cardi walks in. Pills, breakfast. The same old routine, yet this time it feels very different. As Mother Cardi straightens the sheets around me, I hear a thump on the floor. She bends down and picks up my mother's book. It's been living under my pillow, so I must have moved it while I was asleep. I take it from her and rest it on my lap as I look at the garden outside my bedroom window. It's not as beautiful as it once was, so I turn away and look down at the object in my hands instead. A book that's filled with my mother's hopes for me to live a life of love and freedom. Words she wrote for me. She could never have known her life would end so abruptly, that she'd be taken from me within minutes of our meeting, but in this book she'd written words of love, encouragement, and support. When it's in my hands, it's as though she's with me. I flick through it, absorbing snippets, until a lump forms in my throat. I've failed her. I'm nowhere near the girl she thought I'd be. My fingertips find the extra page, added in secret. One line stands out to me. You are loved. You are yours. Not mine, not theirs. Remember that. I wish I knew how to make that a reality, because right now it feels like everything I am is theirs.
Chapter 62. Bram. I can hear. It's the first thing I'm aware of. I hear the humming of a machine, the beeping of a heart monitor, the hissing of fresh oxygen being pumped into the room. It's also piercing and harsh. I can't feel my body. Suddenly my sense of smell returns, as if someone's flicked a switch. Scents punch me in the face and overwhelm my foggy mind. Sterilized equipment, washed linen, even glass. Everything seems to have a distinct smell. These scents grouped together create a picture in my mind, one that I recognize instantly. The tower. My mind races, firing so many questions. Why am I here? What's happened? Where's Eve? Eve. I remember. The Freevers, Ernie, the cryo tank. Has it worked? I'm inside the tower. I try to open my eyes, but they're not ready yet. My eyelids remain closed. If I can smell, I must be breathing. I try to focus my thoughts on the steady flow of air in and out of my mouth. After a few moments, I notice the repetitive rise and fall of my chest as it rubs against the sheet covering me. A sudden blast of noise explodes in my ears as the door to whatever place I'm in slides open. I hear it click shut again and lock. I try to speak. Nothing. I try to move. Nothing. Complete paralysis. I hear footsteps. Someone checks the heart monitor, then slumps into a seat at my side, a button or zip on their clothing scuffing the plastic of the chair. Just relying on my hearing makes it all so sharp and vivid. Then I hear his breath. A sigh. Hartman. The breathy sound escapes my mouth without my needing to think, fueled by a wave of adrenaline at the thought of the plan working, the thought of freeing Eve. Bram! Hartman whispers excitedly. You're awake. Can you hear me? Ernie? I muster just enough strength to mutter his name before the black world turns blacker and I'm gone again. I sit bolt upright. My throat burns. I can't breathe. I gasp for air,
Lashing out, reaching for nothing, I roll off the bed and hit the floor hard. It illuminates as it connects with my skin and glows a soft blue. I can see. Bram! Hartman scrambles to my side. Breathe. I clutch at my throat as my body cries out for oxygen. Hartman reaches over me and pulls out a red tube. He snaps the lid off, revealing a needle, and he doesn't hesitate to stab it into my neck. The chemicals react instantly and my throat widens. Oxygen, sweet oxygen, floods my lungs and I slip away to nothing. Bram, Hartman says softly. I feel his warm hand on the skin of my right arm. Bram. I open my eyes and see my room. Our old room, the one we shared before I escaped this place. Hartman, I sigh, and my cheeks ache with a smile. It's the first time one of those has appeared on this face in a long time. Where's Ernie? I ask. He's okay. You can't get to him, though. They have him now, Hartman says, his round, unshaved face the most welcome sight I've ever seen. Eve? I ask. He pauses. What is it? I ask, forcing my sore muscles to sit up. Whoa, slow down. You're not ready to move yet. Your body has to adjust, he tells me. What about Eve? How is she? I ask. She's okay. There were a few incidents while you were away, Hartman says, removing his thick glasses and pretending to clean them so he doesn't have to make eye contact with me. Incidents? I ask. She's fine for now, but not for long, Hartman says, looking at my heartbeat on the monitor. Today's the day, he says. I stare at him, wanting more information. They're planning the procedure for later today, early evening, he explains. My mind suddenly pieces the puzzle together. She's ready to try carrying a baby. As this thought enters my head, I realize that this baby wouldn't be hers. It wouldn't even be its biological father's. It's their baby, the EPO's. What if it's a girl? What if there are complications when Eve gives birth, eliminating her chances of conceiving again? Would she become disposable, like her own mother? Then we don't have much time, I say, swinging my legs around and placing my feet on the dorm floor. Who else knows I'm here? I ask. Mother Cardi, says Hartman. Mother Cardi? I'm confused. Yes, she reached out to me once news of Ernie's return found its way upstairs. It seems that you share some friends, he says. Frost. My heart sinks as Frost's words echo in my head. We have friends in high places. And I realize the sacrifice he referred to. Mother Cardi was his informant, his wife. Frost didn't make it, I tell Hartman. He gives a knowing nod. She already suspects that. She's not had contact from anyone in days and knew something had happened. She's a good woman, tough, strong. She's ready for your instruction. We all are. All? I ask. When you left here, people began spreading rumors about why you were a wanted man, why you were so dangerous, and not everyone saw it the way the EPO sold it to them. People in here like you, Bram. People want to help. My mind aches with this news. People don't want to be lied to anymore, Bram. They just need to know the truth. They're waiting for you to show them. I reach out a hand and place it on his shoulder. This won't be easy, I say. Of course not, it's you, he replies with a smile. And for a brief moment, I'm pleased to be back. So, what's the plan? You do have one, right? Because I sure as hell didn't go through all this for nothing. Hartman nods to the medical equipment that has transformed our dorm into a small hospital. How are you getting away with this? Has no one questioned it? I ask, finding it hard to fathom how keeping me a secret is even remotely possible. Trust me, since Eve started destroying the place and Ernie turned up, things have been different here, he says, shoving his glasses onto his nose. Plus, I've hacked the sensors in here, so they only show one person's heat signal. I knew I could count on you, I say. Although having Eve's father return and demand to speak with only me did put me under some scrutiny. It's not been a walk in the park by any means, Hartman says, and my mind snaps back to Ernie. Where is he? I ask. Last I heard, they were holding him on the lower levels, Hartman says, as far away from Eve as possible. Smart, I say. Obviously, they don't want her knowing about his return. The pilots have all been strictly briefed on the new codes of conduct, should Eve mention him. Hartman rolls his eyes. So there's no way to get to him, I ask, my stomach pulling at the guilt of sending the old man in here on his own. Hartman shakes his head. How long have I been out? I ask. A while. He shrugs and scrunches his shaggy, unwashed, curly hair. I give him a look. Hey, it took me most of the day to find the damn cryo tank you'd hijacked. Oh, and by the way, you owe me a pack of bubble gum. I told you not to waste it. That stuff is vintage. I roll my eyes at him. It wasn't easy spending so much time down there unnoticed, let alone retrieving your frozen butt and getting back up here without anyone asking questions. Suddenly the floor shudders. I look to Hartman, who seems not to react, like this is normal. It happens again, the vibration causing the screen of my heart monitor to flicker. I stand up, but my legs wobble and fail me. Hartman grips my arm and helps me back to my feet. The window, I say, pointing to the reality TV displays. The screens flicker on as we approach, showing, as always, the grey clouds. I swipe my hand until it shows the outside world in infrared. Suddenly, the windows light up in vibrant reds. Below us swims a sea of hot people, crowding around the base of the tower. They've been out there since Ernie showed up. The numbers just keep growing, Hartman says as we stare out at the enormous crowd surrounding us. I zoom in and see people cheering and chanting. Some hold photos of Eve, or huge banners with Ernie's face on. Others wave painted signs in the air. Free Eve. EPO, let Eve go. Free the truth. The world is watching, Hartman tells me. Then we'd better give them something to see, I say. Where's Mother Cardi? Chapter 63. Bram. Mother Cardi arrives at our door, her nerves visible through the small opening in her veil that reveals her eyes. Mothers are allowed on our level at their own risk, but it's a rare sight. Good evening, Mr. Hartman, she says calmly and casually as she steps inside. No one is in the corridor. Hartman locked the doors and lifts briefly to allow this secret visit. Cardi, I say as I step out of the shadowy corner of the room. She freezes, staring at me. I know she's reading my expression, trying to get confirmation of her suspicions about her husband and son. I'm so sorry, I say, not wanting her to suffer any suspense. She doesn't cry. She doesn't move. She swallows hard and bows her head. Frost and Johnny were strong men. They sacrificed themselves for us, I say. For Eve, Mother Cardi corrects me. For Eve, I agree. I'll get the hang of that eventually. Then we must not let his sacrifice be for nothing, Mother Cardi says, her voice indicating that she's ready to hear the plan. We don't have much time, I say. I need you to give something to Eve. I scan the room. A message. I hold out my hand to show her and she smiles. And what do I tell her? Mother Cardi asks. Nothing. Eve will know how to read it. But I thought the plan would be to get her out, to free her. You are here to rescue her, aren't you? Mother Cardi asks. No. Eve doesn't need saving. She needs to free herself. She needs to see. I'm just going to open her eyes. She'll do the rest, I tell her, and she takes the object from me and hides it under her gown. And once I give this to her, just be ready. You must hide yourself. It will be dangerous. I don't want anyone getting hurt, I say. Her old eyes twinkle at the thought of the events about to unfold. I see the same fire of rebellion in her that I saw in Frost. I bet they once made a formidable team. If this is all you require of me, I'll return to the dome, she says. I'll be delivering Eve's dinner tonight before she's transferred to the hospital level. Then make sure she gets that message before they come for her, Hartman says as he walks her back to the door, checking his monitor first to ensure the hallway is empty. He nods and she leaves. Before the door closes, she turns back to me. For Eve, she says. For Frost and Johnny, I reply. Tears swell in her eyes. Then she turns and disappears into the hallway. Are you sure you want to do this? I ask. There's no other way, Hartman replies without looking at me, his focus set on the suit he's squeezing himself into.
Blimey, I don't know how you wear these things.
I can't help but laugh at seeing him suit up. Lycra does nothing for him. Nice, I say, giving him a thumbs up as he slips the kinetic gloves over his swollen fingers. Don't even start, he says. It seems strange, him gearing up to pilot Holly. Unnatural. But I know he can do it. I trust him. And you're sure you can log into the dome from here? I ask.
Come on, it's me you're talking about,
he says, confidently readjusting his glasses as they slip down his nose on the beads of sweat.
Walk in the park.
But if they trace the signal, you just make sure you get Eve out of there. Don't worry about me. She's more important than all of us, he says. And I nod. I pull the needle from my arm that has been removing the antifreeze drugs and replenishing my blood. I rip the pads monitoring my heartbeat from my chest and drop them to the floor. I'm ready. I have to be. I slip into one of my old jumpsuits, find a pair of my boots, still waiting in their usual spot as though nothing has changed. But everything has changed. This will be the last time I set foot in this room. I've programmed you a window when the security systems will cycle through their test settings. It means they'll power down momentarily, Hartman says, waving his hands furiously over the holo display at his desk, zooming in and out of the schematics of the tower. Momentarily, he repeats. You won't have long to get there. How long? I ask. He pauses, scrunching his hair nervously as he thinks. Hartman, how long?
30,
he replies.
Minutes, I ask.
Seconds, he says, looking back at me. I stare at the projection illuminating his face. My route shown by a thin yellow line that zigzags through the corridors, service stairways, and emergency exits. A small beep interrupts my doubts. It's time, Hartman says, the alarm indicating 10 minutes until Eve receives her dinner. He looks at me. This is it, he says, his magnified eyes looking out at me. I can't think about the possibility of not seeing him again, or what fate lies ahead of him if he's discovered. He stands and we embrace. Friends. Partners. Brothers. Thanks, I say. That word isn't enough, but it's all I have.
Go,
he says, and pushes me towards the door. I hear the emotion in his voice.
Don't screw this up,
I laugh. You know me, I say.
Exactly,
he replies. I stand at the sealed door of our dorm and take a breath.
Ready?
Hartman calls. I look over my shoulder at him.
30 seconds. Don't stop,
he says. He taps his finger on the display and our door swishes open. I hear the clicks of the cameras powering down in the hallway outside.
Go,
he cries. I run.
Chapter 64. Eve. Let's get you dressed, then give you some supper, Mother Cardi fusses as we walk out of the bathroom. No, I tell her. My stomach has been in knots all day. The very thought of food makes me feel nauseous. It'll do you good to have a nice meal, she says, in an irritatingly upbeat manner, before retrieving clothes she's already laid out on the bed for me and handing over my white cotton underwear. I can remember the first day they gave me a bra to try on. It was almost a ceremony. Mother Nina brought in a measuring tape and different sizes of the same white design, while a select few of the mothers joined us, all taking pride in the way my body was changing. The little girl they had raised was slowly turning into a woman. For them, that day was full of hope and promise. To me, it was just another item of clothing, a restrictive one I was relieved to take off at the end of the day. Trousers? I question, with a croak, confused at the sight of the charcoal item she's holding out for me. You'll be in your gown when you go over to see the doctor, but you may as well be comfortable until then, she reasons, shaking them at me. True. I take them from her and put them on. My fingers fumble while I try to fasten them, alerting me to the tremor in my hands that I hadn't realized was there. Here, Mother Cardi says softly. She does up the button, then the zip. Her hands rest on my hips, as though she's trying to steady me. Thanks, I sigh. She picks up a light grey T-shirt, which she gathers together and eases over my head. While I sit on my bed, my mind spacing out over what's to come, she puts on my black socks and trainers. "Put this on too. It's cold in here tonight," she says, as she guides my arms into a black hoodie and zips up